kind of interesting. We have a really different pair of input people for the forum tonight than we have had in the past forums. They're the upfront people, have been mostly sort of elder statesman type, if you will, or people with really vast technical competence in their areas. Well, we have competent people, but with a different kind of competence. Kirk Salveson and Jerry Hoxima. Kirk has been in Central America on a study program, and he'll say a word about that. And Jerry has spent some time on an internship, is that right? When we're on an internship in Washington, D.C., working in Congress, and so they provide a unique kind of resource for us. And the way we'll work it is that each of them will make a kind of short opening statement, and hopefully that will stimulate you all. I'll try again to keep track and make sure that everybody who wants to get their word in gets a chance to do so. I think that the ground rules can go like this. If nobody is saying anything and you want to speak, go ahead and speak. If somebody is speaking and you want to get in, put your hand up, and I'll try to keep tabs on my fingers and make sure that everybody gets a chance to be in on it. So with that ground rules, Kirk, please start us off.
I'm Kirk Salveson. I spent a semester in Mexico, about 4.5 months. In that semester, our study group also went to Nicaragua, and I personally went to Guatemala, and I spent 30 minutes in the El Salvador airport, if that's it. So, I like a lot of discussion at the forums. I like both sides being represented, and I hope that you all feel very free to voice your opinion, whatever it may be. And to stimulate the discussion, I will begin my statement with, we are on the wrong side of every conflict in Central America. If that doesn't get something rolling, I don't know what will. All right. In Guatemala, Rios Montaigne powered last year in March. And in 1 year, Amnesty International has estimated that he has killed 3,000 people. This is our born-again Christian leader that we are supporting. I don't think we're on the right side of this conflict. In El Salvador, a country of 5 million people, it's the smallest country in Central America, the highest density population. Marxist guerrillas are sabotaging the economy. And we are supporting the government, and supposedly these Marxist guerrillas are being trained from Cuba and ultimately the Soviet Union, and they are not disgruntled peasants that aren't being fed, but they are highly trained Marxist guerrillas. I don't think that's true. I don't think a country the size of El Salvador, where every half kilometer you run into another village, I don't think Marxist guerrillas that don't have the support of the people can hide in that country. In Honduras, they've had an election. They had an election last year, but the military still has the power. We have military maneuvers on the border with Nicaragua. We're upgrading military bases on Nicaragua border. We've just built some military bases on this side of El Salvador. We keep on having these military maneuvers and seem to be forgetting equipment that we bring to Honduras with us. We seem to be having some kind of military buildup in Honduras. And if you look at its strategic point, it's next to Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala. This seems to be a very strategic point in Central America. We seem to be forgetting a lot of equipment there. We seem to be very concerned about what the government is about and what the military is doing. In Nicaragua, of course, Nicaragua had a revolution almost 4 years ago now. We're not supporting the Nicaraguan revolution. We're working against it through covert action from Honduras and now from Costa Rica. We're blocking aid. We're blocking parts. We're kind of sabotaging the Nicaraguan government. The Nicaraguan government has abolished the death penalty, has one of the only human rights records that is at least respectable in Central America. The Nicaraguan government seems to be distributing food to all the people. It seems to have religious freedom as well as political freedom. And this is the government that we are working against. Costa Rica has not had an army and is about the only democracy that we've ever had in Central America. And now the United States of America is arming Costa Rica. I don't think we're on the right side of that conflict. Cuba, I'm not real knowledgeable about what's happening in Cuba. It seems to be difficult to get information, but it seems that we pushed Castro to what it is today. Mexico. Let's look at Mexico for a little bit. Here's our neighbor. Mexico. Supposedly, Mexico is a developed country. Yet 50% of the people in Mexico don't have access to medical facilities. The United States is Mexico's first trading partner, and Mexico is our third largest trading partner. And yet Mexico doesn't even have medical facilities for its people. Its education is about in the same kind of shambles. So what are we supporting in Central America? Who are we supporting? What are our interests? It seems to me that our interest seems to lie with the multinational corporation or the large corporation, not with what the people need or want in Central America. In Guatemala, we overthrew the democratically elected government in Guatemala in 1954 after it expropriated United Fruit land. The Dulles brothers and CIA activity were all in that. In 1963, we overthrew a democratically elected government in Brazil. And in 1972, we overthrew an democratically elected government in Chile after it expropriated and it got copper. What will be the government that we overthrow in the 1980s? Will it be Nicaragua? Will it be another one of these governments? It seems to me that it doesn't matter what the people in Central America want, we are going to do what our business interest seems to dictate.
My name is Jay Hooksma. I spent about 8 months or so in Washington, D.C. doing an internship with a nonprofit organization that kept track of what Congress was doing on Central American issues and then distributing that information to people. First, I'll give you a little bit of where I'm coming from. My main premise in regards to this issue or any issue is that you can't solve a violent problem through violent means. And by simply pouring more military aid into the Central American region, it's just going to get worse. I've heard various administration officials accuse Cuba and Nicaragua of arming the guerrillas in El Salvador, but the fact is most of the weapons they're taking off of dead guerrillas come from the United States. They get these weapons from Salvadoran soldiers, and Salvadoran soldiers get them from the U.S. So the vast majority of arms coming into Central America is from the United States. I think that our leaders seem to be blind, at least to me, to the roots of the problems in Central America. And the root of the problem, I think, is poverty. Poor people can't stay poor for very long, and they can't start perceiving injustices without wanting to correct them. And I think that pouring millions and millions of dollars of military aid in Central America, we're simply totally missing the cause. The root cause is poverty, and there's a lot of causes of poverty. Ownership of land is one. Large plantations that grow export crops like coffee and sugar rather than food, which the people can use. The fact that in El Salvador, something like 80% of the land being owned by 14% of the people, plantations where people work almost like slaves, growing export crops rather than what they need to have. I have some figures for 1984 for military assistance that the United States is sending to Central America. To El Salvador, it's $206.3 million in military aid. To Honduras, it's $81 million. And to Guatemala, whom we had not given military aid to for 4 years during the Carter administration, we're now giving $50.25 million in military aid during this upcoming year, during fiscal year 1984. I think this is wrong simply because it doesn't get to the heart of the problem. I think that the United States would do much better, not just in actually sending down food or sending down money to these people, but in working with the governments to correct the existing problems, the problems of land ownership, the problems of what kind of crops are being grown, the problems of the fact that there are no minimum wage laws in most of these countries, that people simply aren't being paid enough. I think that it would involve not just direct aid, but trying to take the idea of justice and implementing it down in Central America. It would involve refusing to support governments who want to work with United States multinational corporations in keeping this unjust system, and instead to encourage governments who want to give the people what's best for them.
Well, we can talk about the clarity of the statements. Go on.
If we can't get word or understanding through our own ambassadors and Congress people, would it be possible or in some way to work with the multinationals down there that are from this country who are trying to work and take care of their business down there to somehow help them turn the situation around and help the people instead of just getting their dollars out? I'm talking about the whole area, but particularly Salvador, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Is that for me?
Well,
I'll take it. Yeah, that issue is just like divestment in companies in South Africa. Can we affect change through being a stockholder? Can we affect change by saying, listen, we know what's going on down there, please stop it? My personal feelings are I don't think that will work. I think the multinationals have made it very clear that profit is the goal. Profit, it's either get big or get out. And again, it's the problem if you don't do it, if you don't exploit, then someone else will just get right in under you and beat you out to it. I don't think the way to work through it is to try to cooperate with the multinationals and say, stop your exploitive business in Central America. I just don't think it will work.
So how can we get at it to help the people?
Well, when I was in Central America and in Mexico, I kept on hearing, we understand that you aren't the same as your government. But that Ronald Reagan believes something different than the American people do. And for me, that's true in some cases. But I think that I am responsible for that government that is in Washington and what it's doing to other people. And I agree, I do feel helpless. I do feel helpless at times. It is so big and I am so small. But a Mexican isn't responsible for the government, and a Honduran isn't, and an El Salvador. I am responsible for it. And I think if we take that responsibility, I think that's the only way you can begin. And granted, you aren't going to have a large effect. I don't think I'm going to convert a lot of people here. I don't think I'm going to convert the world to see the Nicaraguan Revolution as the greatest thing that's ever happened. And I even doubt if it's the greatest thing that's ever happened, but you know, somehow we've got to take this personally. We are responsible for that government, and I think that's the first step, is to claim responsibility for your government, and if you don't agree with it, then start to work for a change. That is what democracy is supposed to be about, is a pairing of all opinions.
I think that probably two-thirds of the people here live within telephone range, not long distance, but local telephone range, of a committee that is named something like Central American Solidarity Committee or whatever, whose function is to create sanctuary space for Central American refugees, and in the process of, usually always in churches, and in the process to call attention to the fact that that these people are not economic but rather political refugees, and then to take the next step, that they are political refugees because of our policies. Those are committees in place in most, in a lot of urban centers in the United States. And they want support and participation on the part of individuals, and they also want very much to get endorsement from local congregations. So that if anyone here wants to speak out in behalf of the political problems in Central America, one can get involved in the sanctuary issue and push that in one's own congregation. This endorsement does not necessarily mean housing a refugee family, but it means endorsing the principle of sanctuary. And then the next step, of course, is providing help for refugees in sanctuary, whether it's financial or other forms of help. I suppose, Jerry, you probably know quite a lot about that, about the sanctuary programs in the U.S., don't you?
For people who really want to get involved, not just in that, but in any kind of action in regards to Central America, there's a whole wealth of sources. It's, at least people can't say, well, we don't have anywhere to go to, because there's a lot. I do know of a couple offices, one in I think it's New York, and the other in Washington, D.C., who have offices that set up sanctuaries across the country. And there's other groups that do things like letter writing campaigns, and there's other groups that publish information, background information on Central America, current updates on what's happening. There are tons of groups springing up all over the country that are doing that.
And not just in urban centers. I'm from Chelan, just down the lake here. We have a peace and justice group there that has some knowledge of the Central America situation. And in Wenatchee, they've started raising bail for Salvadoran refugees that have been in this area and have recently been picked up and arrested and so on. So it isn't something that you have to do. It's somebody out there that knows an update as well.
What you could do if you're interested is to simply write one of these national organizations, and they could just send you addresses or phone numbers or whatever local groups that exist in your area.
Are most folks here familiar with the sanctuary projects that Jerome talked about, or has that come as new information for a lot of you?
New information.
If it is new, stick your hand up if it's really new information, because it might be worth pursuing that a little bit. Do you want to say a little bit more about it, Jerry, about the kinds of mechanisms that are involved and where folks have kind of some of the data behind it?
I can talk quickly about Milwaukee.
Please, that's a good
Milwaukee
example.
The Milwaukee Sanctuary Project is similar to that in other cities or areas.
Can you say something about like background data, about what the refugee situation is?
Well, refugees from El Salvador and Guatemala are pouring into the United States along with Mexicans. But from Guatemala and El Salvador, they're coming. It seems to me, because of political reasons, they are not themselves political, but they fear for their lives because of the conflict between guerrilla and government forces. If they were guerrillas, they would stay and fight. If they were part of the government, they would stay and fight. But they are, for the most part, lower middle class or peasant class people who are simply afraid. And they have seen family members killed, and they flee for their lives. When they come up here, for the most part, again, they will tell you that they do not desire to become American citizens. They simply want to stay here until the conflict is settled in their homeland, and they will be safe to return again. The U.S. government has been rounding them up and sending them back. Western Airlines had the contract to do that. And there was a church action brought about through, what was it? There was a group of Catholic brothers who took an action, and Western Airlines turned out and canceled its contract. But there is, and I don't know what the statistics are, but I know that there is a large, that they've traced the return of these illegal aliens to El Salvador and found that a good many of them have been killed within 6 months of their return to their homeland. So that, for that and other reasons, it's felt that these people should be given political status. In other words, the statutes are set up to accommodate them, to give them rights and privileges in the U.S. as political refugees. But those who have applied for that status, for the most part, have had it denied by the U.S. government, by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So those who are caught are rounded up. Others are in hiding. It's estimated that there could be as many as, 25,000 to 50,000 El Salvadorans in the city of Chicago alone. There's no way of counting. Many of them are kept by friends or other El Salvadorans, who knows. Anyway, there is a movement that is capturing the imagination and support of churches to open church doors to families, and to do this in a very public way. To say, here's an El Salvadoran or a Guatemalan family. They're in our church, Immigration and Naturalization Service people. We have them, here they are, and then to call press and radio and television attention to this. Although, as far as I know, the people's real names are never used, nor are their pictures ever shown unmasked in order to protect the families that they may have in their homeland. But a great deal of attention is given. I mean, I should say that the churches who offer sanctuary make certain that the media know about this. And before sanctuary is ever given, there's a lot of attention to building up a support base among churches. And for example, the church where I am has recently endorsed the sanctuary program. This was a tough road, because there are a lot of people in the congregation who don't like the idea at all, who feel it's illegal, and that comes up. But maybe I've said enough. Huh?
No.
Well, I just I realize now I haven't heard of these sanctuary things, because the area that I live in is a place where these people seem to settle in my neighborhood, and they have a very unkind word for them. And they also, we are warned to report any people or any houses that we see are overpopulated, because people come up to stay with some relatives.
Where is that? Chicago.
South side of Chicago. And we are asked to report in school and the police.
I'd like to just step out of moderator role for a minute just to say one word. One of the things that people involved in the sanctuary project have been trying to do and call attention to by this public act, which is a civil disobedient act, has been to call attention to the fact that it is our opinion that the federal government is in fact in violation of its own law in not granting political refugee status to El Salvadorans and Guatemalans, because the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has recognized them as political refugees, and United States law presumably is party to UN conventions and therefore ought to honor under our own law that recognition by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. And yet the Immigration and Naturalization Service policy has refused to honor it. That's another dimension of the sanctuary witness.
Have the various church bodies, especially within the Lutheran Church, at the national level or synod level or anything, made any statements or one way or the other?
Actually, almost all the major denominations have. I guess that people just must not hear about things that the national headquarters do very much, because most people don't know. But the Lutherans, the LCA and the ALC have, the United Presbyterian Church, United Methodist, American Baptist, United Church of Christ, the Roman Catholics, Disciples of Christ, all of those have made statements opposing U.S. military involvement, first in El Salvador, and then after that, most of them came out with statements against military involvement in Central America in general. And I guess that if you wanted a copy, you could write to the National Headquarters.
Do they support the refugee?
Sanctuary, yeah. To my knowledge, there's no Lutheran statement on the sanctuary issue. At a national level, although I have a recollection, perhaps some of you who are in church bodies do, I have a recollection of a call for some kind of statement to be made.
It really goes synod by synod, district by district, diocese by diocese. The St. Paul Diocese, the bishop there has said that it's illegal, and he has not encouraged congregations to support the sanctuary program. Now, in Milwaukee, just the opposite. The Bishop Weakland of Milwaukee took the lead in that city in supporting sanctuary. In Milwaukee, the LCA bishop has been absolutely silent on the matter, even though he has been prodded to make some kind of commitment one way or the other. He has refused to say anything. So it really, it's a judicatory by judicatory issue.
Isn't it true, though, that all the major denominations have issued statements saying that the Salvadoran refugees should be granted political status?
To my knowledge, that
may be true.
Not
saying breaking the law for sanctuary, no. But I'm positive the United Methodist Church has come out with a statement.
That doesn't surprise me. To my knowledge, there's no Lutheran statement on the issue.
There was, in fact, I worked on this when I was in Washington. We helped organize a petition with four different points, and one of the points was to grant temporary asylum to all six Central Americans who had to leave their homelands because of political strife. And I wish I had brought it with me, it's back in my room. But anyway, this statement was endorsed by several major churches and also by prominent people within each church. The United Presbyterian Church endorsed it, the American Baptist Church, and the United Methodist Church Board of Global Ministries endorsed it, and I think the United Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ. And I don't think that any of the Lutheran churches as a whole did, but several prominent Lutheran people endorsed it. And that statement included several points, but one of them was granting asylum. So that wasn't an official statement coming from the church, but it was something that we got the churches to endorse.
Put a handle on the refugee thing for a second. A journalist when I was in Mexico told me, although I can't prove this and it was never in print, that he said that approximately 1 million Salvadorans are either dead, missing, or out of the country. And that's 20% of the El Salvadoran population. So that gives you a magnitude of the problem. It's not 50, 60,000 people who are running around Mexico trying to get across the border. And Mexico has all sorts of refugee camps along its southern borders, taking up Guatemalan refugees.
A country of 160,000 over 160,000 people here have almost 20,000 refugees. So it's not a small problem at all.
Also, refugee question. The checks and balances or the restraints on presidential power after the Vietnam era would seem to me to preclude him from the 20 million that has been in covert action. Mm-hmm. True, not true. And military buildup in Honduras.
True until 3 days ago. Mm-hmm. Thing is, presidential power doesn't really have a lot to do with it, because Congress can grant, can choose whether or not they want to grant the president what he wants. And the fact that Congress was silent for so long about covert actions while the money for those was being appropriated shows something. And also, every year Congress has a chance to say no to his policies when they're asked to appropriate money for military aid. And so far, every year, no matter how much they protest, they still voted in favor of sending military aid to these countries. So, in a sense, it's not really just presidential power, but it's also congressional power and what Congress decides to do, because Congress does control the money.
We're finished. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I was just going to say that in that sense, people who are against such large amounts of military aid can feel hopeful simply because Congress can be influenced by people. It's not an easy thing to do, but citizen action does pay off sometimes.
The money has been funneled through the national security forces rather than the national armies, and so there's never been a stoppage at any point of the money going through, even though it's illegal. It goes through into the local police system, which then, you know, gets the money and funnels it out. And that's happened in every country in Central America.
Plus, the CIA budget is never itemized.
You'll never hear the administration actually admitting that covert actions are being taken in order to destabilize the Nicaraguan government. They'll tell you that it's in order to stop the flow of arms coming from Cuba through Nicaragua into El Salvador, and they still insist that. And the thing is, last December, the House actually passed 411 to nothing, a bill which stated that there should be no money appropriated for covert actions meant to destabilize Nicaragua. But the president can get around that by saying, well, this money is going in order to keep arms from going into Nicaragua. And so that's how the administration has managed to get around that and continue to send money down there.
Congress also practices mental hygiene. I am a little bit dubious about how to influence Congress. There's a professor at our university who is probably the foremost authority on Nicaragua in the country, who has written the most reputable books, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Goes down 3 or 4 times a year and keeps up with things.
Did you come to my session?
No.
Good.
Offers to testify regularly before Congress on his new findings, and they refuse to have him come. They simply refuse to even hear his word. So it's clearly mental hygiene. They don't want to know because it's just too touchy.
There's never been an iota of proof on the arms flow through Nicaragua. And that has always been one of our points for a peace proposal, is that when you stop the arms flow through Nicaragua to El Salvador, then we will negotiate peace. And Nicaragua said, well, we aren't doing it. But the United States has consistently insisted that that is happening. And when we talked to the ambassador in Nicaragua, he said, yes, it is happening. And I said, well, why don't you just prove it once, and then you've proven it, and then it's over. I mean, you've proven it. He said, no, we need to continue to prove it again and again and again. And he even claimed that they went in small aircraft and dug out canoes, just like they did said in Sojourners. He actually said that through this Gulf of Fonseca.
I thought Al Haig proved that, though. You have pictures and stuff?
Al Haig also seemed to... Al Haig showed pictures of Nicaraguans burning mosquito Indians, which 2 days later were correctly identified as Red Cross people burning Somoza's victims' bodies. Al Haig never retracted that statement. Al Haig also came out and made a lot of statements about Nicaragua's military buildup, but no, never has arms flow to El Salvador been proven.
Oh, something that I heard, I think I read it in Sojourner relating to that, is that shortly after the U.S. made its first accusations that the arms were flowing from Nicaragua and El Salvador, Nicaraguans said, fine, let's have joint border patrols, U.S., Nicaraguan, and you can throw in some kind of neutral country, and we'll just patrol this border, and we'll stop the arms flow, if there is any, and you won't have an excuse for being so mad at us, and we wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. Now, if that really happened, I am very upset with our government.
Our ambassador said that that would not solve the problem, and it is just a word employed by the Nicaraguan government.
I would like to say that I have a little more hope about influencing Congress. I don't know about how to influence Congress as a whole, but I've had pretty good luck with our congressman from our 4th district here in Washington. He started out, he's basically a party line person, he's a Republican, and basically it sounded like his policies on El Salvador, on nuclear arms, on everything was just what he'd heard from the party caucus, essentially. Through some citizen education of this man, he is starting to have lots and lots and lots of doubts about the party line. We visited him in his office once, and he basically said he was unhappy with a lot of the Central American policy. And he's to the point now, I think, that if there were more votes on the subject and more education, that he would probably be voting differently than he would have been, say, a year ago. I'm really convinced of that. Part of the problem, though, is there's very little going on about Central America other than just sort of standard, well, let's vote another budget in, because there isn't enough of us out there saying, hey, we think this is an issue. This is an issue now. It continues to be an issue. It's always going to be an issue until that gets sorted out and people quit dying again using American money. But it dies out in the paper. We don't hear about it. If there isn't anything very specific that seems to be affecting U.S. policy, then there's no votes on it. Well, was it 2 years ago that the Congress voted and said, if the president has to certify the human rights progress every 6 months before they can have money. Every 6 months, the president says, yep, sure, it's great. First time around, I think he gave it 5 pages. There was a lot of stink. The second time around, they made it 200 pages. But every single time that it happens, Congress does not get off of its butt and say, it is not true, we know that it's not true, and we're not going to vote you any more funds. And the reason Congress doesn't do that is because we don't keep the pressure on enough, and I'm as guilty as anyone.
Although one thing I'd like to add is that there are some good, some congresspeople that that my group did quite a bit of work with who were leaders in trying to pass legislation which affects this area. For example, last year, Representative Stutz from Massachusetts introduced a bill which would have made certification, the certification process for this. He recognized it for what it was. There are some Congress people who sincerely want to help. It's just that, well, for one thing, they're outnumbered by far. And I think that they need a lot of encouragement in what they're doing. So I think it's important, if you've made a habit of writing to your congressperson, to remember to thank that person whenever they vote for a certain bill or whatever, and to simply let them know that you appreciate the work that they're doing. Because it's, despite the fact that the House is supposedly liberal, voting against military aid is still a very unpopular position to take, and if you're a congressperson and you want to hang on to your job, then you don't like to take risks. And that's the fact about our system, is that you have to be voted in order to be in Congress, and in order to get votes you have to give people what they want, so that kind of makes it hard for congresspeople who really take their job seriously and who really think of these questions as moral questions.
There's the image of the conservative, normally a Republican, but not necessarily, receiving as reelection money from some of these multinational corporations that stand the gain by us supporting the governments, you know, regardless of their human rights or their lack of human rights policies. Is that an oversimplification, or is that basically a true
statement?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's a lot of lobby pressure in Washington, and it's coming from the president, it's coming from multinationals, certainly trying to think of a state that has somebody from Oregon isn't going to vote against the lumber bill. I think there is a lot of pressure. And I think that multinationals and large corporations have a lot more influence on what's happening in Congress than we do. Yet they're supposed to be representing us and not business interests. So, yeah, I think it's a difficult spot to be in. For a person that wants to keep his or her job, you better be popular, or else you don't have your job anymore.
You know, I really question whether voting against military aid to Central America is as unpopular as Congress thinks it is. We did an interesting thing in Chelan on, it was the day before the elections in El Salvador. We did a walk around and we had people signing petitions. And I was absolutely astounded. It's a fairly very conservative conversation. I was astounded at the people who were signing a petition saying, just get us out, this is dumb and stupid and we don't want to be in there. We shouldn't have American money in El Salvador specifically. Mm-hmm. I think that there's something going on that Congress is still reacting to perceptions of what they think America thinks about Central America. That for years that has been the case, that we wanted to protect our interests down there and not really know anything about it. You guys just take care of it. Support the right side so the American way of life is preserved down there or something. I don't know. I think that that's changing now. I had just dozens of extremely conservative people, a lot of them very hawkish, a lot of them very concerned about the communist threat there and everywhere else, but still saying somehow it wasn't right to be there, it wasn't useful to be there, and we should be out. So maybe what we need to do is in our communities, do some survey taking and pass that along if you find that that's what you're finding. Mm-hmm. Pass that information along to your congressman. Say, look, we've got 6,000 signatures in a town that you wouldn't expect to be there.
And just to be fair, there's a lot of Congress people, even former conservatives, who are having doubts. One of the strongest bills this year against military aid to El Salvador, but one which would have cut the president's request in half, came from Senator Dodd and Senator Inouye, who are Democrats, but also from Nancy Kassebaum, who's a Republican from Kansas, and she's not real hard conservative, but fairly conservative. And for her to come out and say that she disagrees with the president's policy in Central America is a really big deal. And so that kind of made us think that maybe even some of the middle or conservative Congress people are starting to rethink about what we're doing down there, and maybe starting to think that by just pumping military aid down there in massive quantities is not the best way to solve the problem. So,
those of us who are members of the American Lutheran Church realize that in the San Diego Convention last fall, there was a resolution that our Bishop President Preuss and other district bishops who were interested and able to go were to go down there into Central America. I don't know which countries particularly they plan to visit, but probably Nicaragua as one of them. And I'm just very interested in knowing what can be done from our side of the fence to try to encourage them in whatever ways we can to really find out things, and secondly, what we can do through them when they come back in terms of reaching Congress and making a witness there.
It must be in the vicinity of a year and a half to 2 years ago now. A statement was published, kind of an open letter statement, by American Lutheran Church leaders who were in Central America under Lutheran World Ministries auspices. To my knowledge, while that letter was published, it never got very much play from any of our jurisdictional mechanisms, and was never channeled very widely.
That's true, and I think an upshot of that, though, was the resolution in San Diego that Bishop Preuss and others go and do some more work on that.
We're talking about the problems in Central America, country by country. Has there been any movement towards looking at it or making a policy as a Central American policy so that all governments are held up to the same standard? And is there any talk within the Central American governments themselves or uniting in some way?
I think it would be highly difficult to unify Central America into one country. If we look at the history of Central America, it's always been agitated with political unrest. And it's just countries are going not by government, administration to administration, but revolution to revolution. I don't think there's much chance right now of a unified Central America. As far as a Central American policy, supposedly we have one that's for the general area, but it seems to be directed or manipulated in certain ways for each country. I don't know what more you want.
Do you mean government policy, our government?
I was interested as to if we mentioned the thing on human rights. And whether or not that's going on in El Salvador, there must be some yardstick of measurement.
Mm-hmm.
No? Yes?
Yes, but it's lengthened and shortened for the various countries. If we support the country, they all seem to look pretty good. I don't think we've ever... There's never been a country that we support that hasn't had a good human rights record. And there's never been a country that we don't support that has good human rights record. Maybe that's an overgeneralization, but I really don't think that.
No, considering El Salvador doesn't have a good one, it's just getting better.
It's improving. And we, you know, it's a sovereign government, so we don't want to, like the statement I made earlier.
Well, there is the Organization of American States, the OAS.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the Central American countries are members of that, as are we. And there have been some overtures through the OAS from other Latin American countries to mediate between the United States and El Salvador and Nicaragua. But the U.S. has pretty much turned a deaf ear to these ovations from other Latin American countries. So it would be within our purview as the U.S. government to work more through the OAS, but we haven't done that.
Mexico and Venezuela have offered to mediate. And last fall, in fact, something like 200 Congress people signed a petition to the president saying, please take up their offer. And the president took note, but he didn't act on it. He didn't do anything about it. And the petition and the offer just kind of fell to the wayside, I guess. So I don't know. I think that he must have ignored it and just hoped that it would go away.
Was there not a meeting between some of the Central American countries a few months ago?
Yes, but it didn't include Guatemala or Nicaragua because those governments shot their way into power as the United States saw it. Since they didn't have an election, they weren't included. So they're trying to deal with the Central American problem without dealing with some of the governments of Central America.
Well, who had started that? Who initiated that?
Well, Mexico did, and Venezuela. But it was decided, and the United States does have a large amount of influence in that organization, that the governments that hadn't had an election would not be participating in that meeting of states, and that it just happened to be two of the governments in Central America. So there was nothing resolved at that meeting.
I was just going to say that it's interesting that Mexico has taken a very conciliatory attitude. And yet, if the domino theory is true, they have a great deal to lose, because the Mexican government surely knows of the unrest within its own borders, and yet they maintain friendly relations with Cuba and with Nicaragua, and are not highly supportive of U.S. policy in El Salvador. And for all the flaws of the Mexican government, it seems to me that they're being rather cool-headed about foreign relations with Central America and with Cuba. And I think we could learn something from them.
My friend Tom talks about this as window dressing on the part of Mexico.
Think so?
Yeah, he said it's because they want to be remembered as a revolutionary country, and yet their actions within the last 15 years have been anything but revolutionary, and this is a way for them to maintain some kind of alliance with revolutionary governments in that area. And he feels as though they know it's going to fail, so that's why they stuck their neck out. Mm. But that's just his opinion. Mm. Yeah. He's just window dressing.
I want to address what this gentleman over here was talking about. What can we do? I know that there were some ALC people in the southwestern district of Minnesota that went down to Central America last year, and the follow-up was great. They're very busy at the district office, but I know that one woman came to a youth meeting that I got together and showed slides of Nicaraguan people, very down-to-earth, talking about the beautiful children and the people and the social minister and not all the politics of it, just for empathy with these people. I would think that would be a responsibility of most people that go down there. I also talked to Bob Gussick, who is head of border concerns, or I guess he's going out, but border concerns down there. And he seems to think, I asked him what I could do, and he thinks that a lot of people in Nicaragua who have had visitors come spend so much of their energy and time trying to accommodate all these Americans that they think that there's some other things we could do as far as political action here in the country. He said that the people there are hospitable, but it's wearing thin, at least the ones that he knows, because he's been in Guatemala a bit. One suggestion I would have is to talk to the people at LIRS. She came, this woman, Mary Solberg, came to talk to a Lutheran student movement group that was having a retreat that I went on. And she compiled things. Her specialty is El Salvador, and there's a whole compilation of statistics and stories, personal stories from these people in a book, in pamphlets that you could get. And she had amazing stories to tell about how many refugees have been granted asylum, like 25 out of, I don't know.
10,000,
yeah. And I think that they're very worthwhile materials, and I know she goes all over the country, as well as some other people. And she has a lot to say about El Centro and the refugee camps there down in California.
What did Reverend Gussick have to say when you asked him what more you can do.
Well, I asked him about the people, oppressed people down there from Mexico south. You know, what can we do? And he seemed to think that going into Mexico, into Tijuana, which is right over the border from where I live, I could just help tutor people in English. That would be a major asset. He said, do what you can, but don't tax, overtax the people.
Nothing toward our government.
Pardon?
Nothing in relation to our government.
No, he was, yeah, I was asking personally what I could do.
One thing that I heard a lot of times in Mexico and in other countries was, we understand what needs to be done in our country. We understand what isn't going right, and we think we can change that. What we need is not for you to tell us how to do it, but to help us do it. And that's a whole change in how we formulate our policies in Central America.
Jerry, what would you look for?
Which group?
Yeah.
Coalition for a New Foreign and Military Policy.
There are some wonderful films to use in churches and in ministries. And there are ways to, you know, give money to the literacy campaign in Nicaragua. There's all kinds of things to do to raise consciousness, to build this kind of support that Jerry's calling for. Do you have the names of those films, you think?
Actually, there's the coalition and a lot of other groups oftentimes put out resource lists with their publication. For example, the coalition does this thing called COSA four times a year, and they always list new films, new books, new just about everything that has come out, and where you can send to for it. And all you really need to do is get a hold of these publications that are put out by these different groups. And you usually have resource lists. Sojourners has some pretty good resource lists too. And the other side and magazines like that. If you can read things like that, then you'll find out, I think, about things that you can use in your church. For anybody who wants to know, on the bulletin board in the dining hall, there's some addresses of groups that you can write to for information or resources or whatever. And they're classified according to different issues.
Jerry, do you still get the Coalition newsletter?
I have the last one.
Did you get one like yesterday or so?
I'm trying
to say is we have a really up-to-date, maybe that's it. I haven't even opened one.
Well, the last one, I'm not subscribing to it right now. But the last one I have is dated June 9th. And it probably one or two have come out since then, but I haven't gotten it.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say, for people that really have feel now that the discussion has gone on long enough, if you want to try something specific, I do have the newest newsletter from the Coalition. As I say, I haven't looked at it yet, but I'm sure it has specific things about bill numbers and things that are happening in Congress.